It's not an especially long way to San Francisco from Seattle, 12 hours by car, 2 by plane, but from the Suquamish Indian Reservation to Naropa University and then San Francisco and back, that sounds like a lifetime. It is the path of one of the most talked about younger poets on the West Coast. San Francisco poet Cedar Segal was raised on the Suquamish Res and homeschooled there after 7th grade. In 1995, he was awarded a scholarship to study writing and poetics at the Naropa Institute, now Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. Called The Second Coming of the San Francisco Renaissance, his new book, Stranger in Town, published by the iconic City Lights of that same city, has been called a reality made of poetry and a poetry where narratives of urban mysticism are pursued. It's our pleasure to welcome Cedar Segal back to Seattle.
Hi.
How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It's quite a trip from Suquamish Nation to Naropa and then San Francisco and then getting published in City Lights. How did folks at Naropa find a brilliant young poet on the res?
I had heard of Naropa through the Barry Miles biography of Allen Ginsberg. And I read that. And I read, of course, a lot about Naropa in the section that had to do with the 1970s. And I thought to myself at the time of reading it, does this place still exist? And then I kind of, I finished that book and I was well into the Beats and that literature. And then in Poets and Writers, I found a small ad in the back for the summer writing program, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. And I was about to graduate high school. And so I had my mother like look into it, and she called Max Regan, who was running it, and she sort of acted, I felt like she acted more like an agent than a mother or something, like acting like, what can you offer him sort of thing. And she told my mother about, they were desperate to get people of color there, and there was a scholarship, Students for Ethnic Inclusion, such a terrible name, but and so she gave my mother the details of that, and I applied for it, and I got it.
What did Naropa do for your writing practice? I mean, what was it like going there?
Well, I first went for the summer writing program, and so that's what they offered me the scholarship for. And that was just a real crash course, because at that point, I had only really read Jack Kerouac, maybe Langston Hughes, Allen Ginsberg, you know, the usual names. But then that summer they were doing like a tribute to the work of Robert Duncan. So I took a lot of notes and I just wrote down every proper noun I was hearing under the tent. And I actually stayed in this large boarding house with all the faculty, which is how I met Joanne Kiger and a bunch of other poets, just staying in very close proximity with them. And it was, I mean, then I just decided after that summer, I got so much information just sort of pouring over everything I'd written down during the seminars and the readings. And I liked Boulder enough, so I just applied for their BA program. And I had to come back to Suquamish for like 6 more months, and I got a job and just saved my money. And then I went back immediately to Boulder and started studying in the writing and poetics program.
Who are some of your favorite teachers?
I would say definitely Anne Waldman. And in the summer I studied with Alice Notley, which was very memorable. Anselm Hollow for the core faculty. Those are the people that I ended up really studying with, taking courses with. And Lisa Jarnot, who's a great poet. They were always really good about that, bringing in younger poets just for a semester or two. From New York or from a major city. And when I was there, what I really liked about it was really like, it was what you made it, you know. It was, if you had talent and you were really hard on yourself and you did a lot of reading, then it would pay off. You know, they kind of left you alone to they would turn you on to things, but I think I really made the most of that program by just in the workshops and everything. I was just as hard on myself as I was on everyone else. I think I had a reputation for maybe being like pretty harsh on other people's work or something, but I was just as hard on myself. I really wanted to get to try to figure out what my content was and how did I want my poetry to sound too.
It seems to me that Naropa is a place where there could be a lot of, you know, rich kid slackers.
Yeah, I was appalled when I got out of Naropa to see how few people continued to write. I got the sense later on that they had just been killing time, where I was learning this thing that I felt definitely that I was in it for life, whether or not I had another job or not, that I would always be writing and publishing my poetry.
Yeah, but not everybody goes there with that same intent.
Yeah, I didn't even. Yeah, I guess I took it really seriously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an amazing place to take seriously, because it's really unique in terms of, you know, a poetry experience, poetry educational experience on the continent. There's not much like it.
Right, and when people would make comparisons to like Black Mountain College and things at the time, I would sort of scoff at it and think it was funny. But now, as I've gotten, you know, I went there in 96, and, you know, it's like 10 years have passed, and now I see that that is very true, you know, and now I think Naropa might, I think they, I'm not sure what the state, I think they're having problems now. I don't think it's quite what it was when I was there either, so.
No, it seems as that was the heyday, and maybe before the Merwin incident.
Oh, yeah.
But certainly during your time as well. Talking with Cedar Siegel, he's the author of Stranger in Town. It's published by City Lights. I'm Paul Nelson. Stranger in Town, that's the title of the new book. So are you a movie fan or a Bob Seger fan, or is this a reference to your life in San Francisco?
I always loved, it's the name of a song by Del Shannon, the guy that sang Runaway. And so I always just loved that title so much, and so I just used that. It seemed so like intriguing, or something like you'd get in a dime store novel, you know.
Poetry noir.
Right, yeah, definitely.
Do you want to read the title piece? Could you do that?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Do you remember what page it's on? I should have marked it there.
Oh, it's okay. I can find it. It's only 80 pages long.
And there it is, yeah.
Yeah. Stranger in Town. Life in unbridled collapse. Let tuneful praise ascend. Not a single line out of step with my band. Aboard the riverboat, when the sun shone red and especially dark upon my room, I was shown to 3464, once Jack London's, I was told. The black forest alcohols filled my mind, my one and only skull with rock crystal, the butcher's field. Its grass and the stream cut my rooms in three. I write and I laugh to think again upon the stream. Its demon black mask lights underneath. My servants stay fine and lower their eyes. I proclaim the empire, my coat of arms and cigarettes, to be held across facades of cathedrals, crimson the flight. More than one death from a square bottled ink, the Marvel brand. I enjoy reading signs through the fog, Hotel Huntington. Then that evening, and all of Fox Plaza was the same white. A permanent stripe on my blue bike, I raise my hood. I think there are other lost men in surrounding blocks alike in their thinking. There is no other man to enjoy such fog besides me, to wander tracks in clear, star-cut ground. I am sorry I said he was already high. We got so high together, and I forgot to say. I had invested a lot in my first walkthrough, the greatest Marco Polo, single file, best roulette. There's a bad moon on the rise, and I've got quite a stash. Rubbings from the Calligram graves. I have explained their hollows and brick, a cross where it is written in script, young blood, straight edge. Impossibly accurate, the fifth wristwatch, diamond on the 12. I have reached the cave, it has been shot up, and I am punished to this day. Ruby under black letterpress, my name goes first.
There's this interesting quality of your work of really, well, not really abrupt leaps, but leaps, certainly a non-linearity that goes with it. Is this the way your mind works, or do you have to work the poem to get that quality in there?
A lot of the time, I use a typewriter a lot, and I load the typewriter, and sometimes I'll just leave the paper in the carriage and type when I want to, and maybe it'll go on, you know, maybe just one day or over the course of like 3 days, probably at the most, and then I get all the material down, and then I'll usually leave it alone for a day and come back to it, and then I start editing and adding sometimes too. But a lot of the time, I think it's just the way I hear things. I hear things in a dislocated way sometimes. But I think if you string something in next to it, that sounds, you know, the sound can lead the sense of it. I've always been a person that even if I'm reading the most lyrical poetry, sometimes like the actual meanings are totally lost on me, and I'm really focusing in on like, I'm making it more difficult than it sounds sometimes. And then, so I think it's, but I definitely take things away and then add things. And yeah, but it's not to be obscure. You know, it's actually you leave things out sometimes in order to make the experience fuller.
There's an interesting line in the book. There's a segment on poetics, and you say in it that you like to leave in all the sleepwalking and nosedives between lines.
Right, yeah, the sleepwalking and nosedives between lines. Yeah, what else do I say there? yeah, I like to leave in the sleepwalking. Oh, I forget what I was saying about that. Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Now it seems that if you don't leave in all the sleepwalking and nosedives between lines, you should just not bother. Well, just that it's also that thing of don't do in poetry what is best left to prose. Like, it almost can't be, like, too lyrical for me to consider it poetry almost, unless it's like conceptual or I don't know, or unless it's being written like as a letter or a direct address to someone. But
there has to be some room for the imagination, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but there also has to be room for the ear to, like, you do have to make it new in a way. But I think that, I mean, it's very much just the way that I hear things. And I used to think, gosh, I used to worry between poems, oh, I'm never going to write another poem and all this. And then I realized recently, it's like you don't lose your way of hearing language. So this is my way of hearing language, this book. And but it's funny because everybody says that, you know, there are these things that are fused together that, you know, otherwise wouldn't be and all that stuff. But it is, it's not too worked over. I can say that.
Right.
You know?
There was something about in that particular piece you were reading from, something of the unconscious that's still there, is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I never want that. You know, I think every poet knows that point where you are scrubbing that out, and then there's nothing left. You know,
right,
you
right.
go too far in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned, you know, how you hear language, and I'm thinking growing up. On the Suquamish Rez, was one of the languages you were hearing Lachute Seed? Did you learn much of that?
I knew, yes, elders that spoke Lachute Seed, in particular, Vi Hilbert.
Tachablu, yeah.
Yeah, and so she was amazing. Lawrence Webster, other great elders that are no longer with us. And so I did hear it. It's very throaty. It's very like my name in Lachute Seed is Chapayats. It's very like almost like Inuit, too.
Yeah, there's a chief Seattle. I think that Seattle's name was Siat.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost Middle Eastern, too. I always hear a kind of a similarity with some of that.
Is Chief Seattle an ancestor of yours?
Yes. My dad has it all. He has the family tree drawn by hand, like at his house. I'm not exactly sure, but Jacob Saigo, the son of Chief Seattle, is I think my great 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 grandfather. Yeah.
Yeah. How else does you know? There's some references in the book. There's a poem called "Daybreak Star." Of course, is center on Magnolia, Native American center. There's a poem called "Port Orchard," which is, of course, across the water from the part of part of the world where you come from. There's a reference to Pioneer Square. Is this how your old life manifests in your work, or is there other ways?
Well, I've always wanted to write more about the Pacific Northwest. I think the lighting here and that was very, very influential. And taking the ferry over at night, you know, I never took that stuff for granted. And and I've always wanted to recreate it in my work. And I don't think I've really gotten that close. I think maybe the first poem in this book, Prince Valiant, that was probably the closest I got. And I was excited by that. I mean, I put in that I just think the word Port Orchard is so beautiful. And so I use that as a title, as sort of a trigger. And the other references, they're sort of fleeting references. I mean, it's kind of like, it's much easier for me to, it's almost like I've kept Seattle in my mind under glass or this area. And it's hard for me to write about it. Because I left it.
But the time is coming.
Yeah, I hope so. Maybe I can write about it in prose more. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Do you want to read that first poem?
Sure, yeah.
Talking with Cedar Seago, his new book is called Stranger in Town. It's published by City Lights. I'm Paul Nelson.
Prince Valiant, your first presence is that of a con man down on his luck. You cross on the ferry and return as it gets dark. Heating a pair of candlesticks to warm the studio. I was to live quite comfortably at the end of each needle to receive my ghost. I took out a writing room also among derelicts who would pay unwittingly the highest prices. Besides the apartments for their dry cleaning and drinks, top of the mark. Soiled by each groom till I reach the morgue. One we can lean on in our ascension to heaven, to China Fields and the cufflinks you had better recognize. It was more of an open invitation, and should he care to appear, good thing it was recorded. His walking seaside, his being punished for talking Indian, a bronze bust soon to be unveiled in Pioneer Square, the greatest of all features in its design, mercy. The brass ring and clear purple tomb in a doorknob.
Yes, I was taken by that he's being punished for talking Indian in that particular poem. And that's something that probably happened, I'm going to guess, to your grandparents' generation.
Yeah, that was taken from an oral history transcript. It was, that is a quote from Lawrence Webster. And he was speaking about boarding schools. I forget which one he was relocated to. But yeah, when they got there, they were forced to learn English. And I think they were severely punished for speaking the only language they knew.
They were beaten for speaking Lakota, or whatever the indigenous language is. You say that your books feel like interruptions almost.
Yes. Yes, I mean, I've been, you know, I started at Naropa in 96. I moved to San Francisco in 99. And, you know, I assembled this book from several existing stapled books. And it wasn't, you know, I only assembled this manuscript after the editor at City Lights got in touch with me and asked me to do it. And, you know, I just feel like more often than not, it's, I'm not a careerist in any sense. I could be more organized in that sense. but that's what I mean. They feel like interruptions. My life is totally, I've just given it over to poetry. But it's very informed by, I know a lot of visual artists and a lot of musicians in San Francisco. It's just as my work is just as informed by you know, those other art forms, just as much as it is the poetry scene in San Francisco or elsewhere. And I've had so much fun. You know, I just want to stress to people, I remember William Carlos Williams, he said, well, why do we forget to tell people how much fun it is? You know, it's so much fun. And it's just given me that it's just, I can't go wrong continuing to write it.
So the interruptions, the books are interruptions from the actual writing of it. So assembling the books and getting published and doing all that, it's kind of a hassle that takes you away from what you're really supposed to do.
Exactly. I'm completely wrapped up in it. And I always had the intention, I guess, you know, and but I always had faith more than anything that it would happen, that it would be with a publisher that I would be excited by working with, too. And
City Lights qualifies.
Yeah, it was great. And I just didn't have to. The other thing is, I've never been one to, you know, send my work to the Chicago Review, this or that, and what have you. You know, I do always, I mean, I submit when people invite me to, and my whole, you know, career, if you want to call it that, is based on that, really, so far.
An organic process.
Definitely, yeah.
And speaking of your process, you just mentioned the music community in the Bay Area a long time, jazz nexus, really, the Live at the Black Hawk and all the poetry and jazz combinations from the 50s on. But you say in the book that your process has shifted from having another poem or line which would launch you into writing a poem to being out hearing music or being at an art exhibit.
Yeah, definitely. Nowadays, it seems almost like the way that I'm opened up to poetry is, it seems more conceptual, or like I need like a side entrance, something to like trick me into writing poetry. And a lot of times it's been through having a lot of friends that are visual artists, and so I'll write something to them. Even if when it's published, it isn't, you know, dedicated to them explicitly. But that's what triggered the writing, is, you know, someone else who's doing what I feel very similar to my process, but they're doing it in, you know, with actual tactile materials. Or writing for someone for their birthday, or writing a poem for someone's birthday, or just like lowering the bar, actually. It's interesting. It's like, but it makes me sort of relax and just, I don't know. It's, as I get older, I feel that I'm doing it just for, not because I feel I need to produce more poetry, but just there's more, I don't know how to say it exactly. But yeah, I'm just way, writing happens for me after, I want to get as close to the other arts as I can through this, so poetry almost acts as a screen, you know.
It those other arts, if it's anything like it is for me, they create a different kind of state of consciousness.
Yeah.
And you write from that.
Yeah, exactly. The starting point is less bookish. It's more like something that, where you're drawn out of your head almost,
right,
and
right.
You return to it through poetry.
Right. Yeah. Are there any examples in the book that you could illustrate?
Yeah, this one, the last poem in the book, which was actually an email to a close friend. It's called Untitled Nijinsky. Lots to confess, your best interests, if you are so inclined, to backroom show business memoir, walking through clear water in a pool painted black. I just slip in and out and seem to be drawn to a place by folks who don't know where they want me, but I do in fact appear. Then held over several weeks, backroom blood-sucking donkey show. I once saw a picture of John Wiener's arriving to an opening of John Chamberlain's, twisted, with a not quite long enough ponytail greased. He appeared to be sleepwalking. I think it was mid-60s. I am wearing a more Genet-style sailor's top now, about to run down to the dock. The fleets come in. I could have had them all along, 10 years. I've loved you once too hard and twice too soft now. three times a lady.
How about we shift gears? What inspired Notes on Joan Crawford?
I was sitting at a bar with a friend, and he brought up Joan Crawford, and I was, so excited. But the way he was appreciating Joan Crawford was just sort of this carnal, heterosexual male point of view, about how she was this hot piece of ass and whatnot. And my appreciation of Joan is so the opposite. It's almost like pure camp, So he had no idea about all these like campy details that I hold as, almost religious in my mind.
Mommy Dearest.
Yes, Mommy Dearest, what have you. And so I wrote it really as a tutorial to this straight man about, all the things I hold dear about Joan's legacy. And it goes back to what we were saying, that was written for, I mean, that's sort of the side entrance I'm talking about. It's written as a tutorial for, I mean, the engine for the thing. I like to have a reason to write a poem, an occasional poem, let's say.
Yeah. Would you want to read that poem?
Oh, sure.
Notes on Joan Crawford.
Yeah, it's sort of the comic relief in this book here. Sure.
Yeah. If beating your children can be seen as funny.
Exactly. Yeah, a certain kind of sense of humor. where is that one? Yeah, it's not that far. Oh, yeah, here we go. Notes on Joan Crawford. Metro used her real-life exposure to the lower classes. Her mother was a laundry woman. It is said that Joan would hand her clothes from off the line. She fled Texas and found immediate success upon the casting couch. Then, having landed a spot in a chorus line of New York, she was asked to entertain executives out from Hollywood. This seemed to open doors, and she was soon moved to Brentwood. A majority of early vehicles cast her as a little shop girl, The Women. She had a string of hits into the 40s, but was suddenly labeled box office poison and asked to leave Metro. She would gain her revenge signing with Warners, winning her first and only Best Actress Oscar for Mildred Pierce. She is increasingly showing her age. She once accepted an Oscar on another woman's behalf and for spite, reportedly beat the fuck out of two adopted children, owned her own ill-fated casino, Vienna's, in Johnny Guitar. She married Albert Steele, the magnate behind Pepsi Cola, and did remain on its board of directors after his sudden death. She ended in B-horror, Baby Jane, Berserk, and her last feature, Trog, 1970. She took whatever crumbs were offered on television, one foot in the grave. Her last was an episode of Night Gallery. She plays blind. It was Spielberg's first professional job. He has recalled there being a lot of cue cards used, large type editions.
I remember that show Night Gallery, too. That's weird.
Yeah, I rewatched that episode recently. It's called Eyes. And it's great. I mean, the whole story centers around the sun, which is actually the name of that essay that we were quoting from earlier.
That's right. That is the name of the essay. John Wieners, Jack Spicer, and Ted Berrigan are among the poets who are sources for a workshop that you're preparing for the 100,000 Poets for Change event at SPLAB. Can you talk about their influence on your work and what you find interesting in their work?
Yes. When I moved to San Francisco in 1999, I was talking with the poet Joanne Kiger, who's a friend of ours, and she explained to me that the Hotel Wentley was a few blocks from where I was staying. I was living at Polk in California at the time in a little residential hotel. And she explained to me that where he had written that beautiful sequence, the Hotel Wentley poems, that building was still standing at Polk and Sutter, which was literally like three blocks down or something. And so when she told me that, I started to get more interested sort of in the history of San Francisco, in particular the San Francisco Renaissance. And that was around the time of Poet Be Like God and The House That Jack Built, the two Wesleyan books devoted to Jack Spicer, one biography and one book of his lectures. And so, I don't know, I'm glad that I got into that stuff that first year that I was in San Francisco. It made me, I think it made me just want to stay in town, even though, I mean, I was really broke for that first year. But I think learning about all of that stuff and really, you know, really taking it seriously, looking for the first editions of their books and that kind of thing, really going out of my way to kind of get a sense of what it was like in the 50s and the early 60s. And then, and then Ted Berrigan, he's always been a great, one of my favorite poets. But I think the trick about Ted Berrigan is so many people, it's a sort of like O'Hara, like they're very easy to imitate if you read them too much. You know, the secret is sort of not to take the content, but to take what the dynamic and language that they're working with. You see so many people, like, I think, take from O'Hara and Berrigan, but in the way that is like fairly obvious.
Well, there's a sassiness that comes, and that's reflected in your work, but it's more than that.
Yeah, I know. I was really happy to see. I was afraid that the poems, that Stranger in Town, would come out dark overall, but then I don't think it does, and I'm very proud of that. I thought that it would seem dark, but it doesn't seem like that as much mm-hmm. as I thought it would.
There's one last line I'd like to ask you about, and it's in the poem Morning Train, mm-hmm. and in it you say, "I am strongest before the world wakes."
Oh, yeah. That was written in the morning, and I've lived with my boyfriend for like 10 years in this same apartment in San Francisco, and it's the time sort of before he gets up, and if I get up, you know, and my mind, even though I, you know, a lot of people, I'm great in the mornings, like when I wake up, especially after coffee, it's like I'm really good at editing in the morning. Sometimes I'm not good at like drawing up things to actually write about, but I'm really good with editing. But I wrote that line, and I think that poem, it's broken into three sections, and I knew I had the first two, and the third one was written in the very early. I had gotten up what I thought was too early, but I ended up finishing that poem off.
Love the mornings. I just absolutely love it. I write every morning, and I love that time of day. And I get very protective and very angry when it's taken away from me.
Yeah, I think that's really, I mean, and you feel, yeah, but no, I felt like that it was inordinately early that morning that I got up, and it felt like I was, you know, that feeling that you have the feeling that you're the only one awake, you know, not just in your house, but, you know, as far as you can see. Yeah, I was interested in that. When you read about certain writers, like their habits, like, did they use a pencil, pen, type, or would they write through the night, or would they get up early and write, and for how long? And I think the habits of writers are very interesting.
Yeah, I told George Bowring I'd come and interview him, and I said, you know, mid-afternoon, I said 3 o'clock, and he said, I'll probably still be in my pajamas.
Uh-huh.
In the afternoon, so up in Vancouver. Well, how about leaving us with a poem, Morning Train?
Oh, sure. Great.
So, talking with Cedar Siegel, and he's reading from the new book, Stranger in Town. It's published by City Lights. There we go.
Morning Train for Micah Ballard. I have a room for three nights. It pays me no mind. My lines are columns pulled up and straight sinking. I begin to see burned in every verse an alcove, a rest, a bloody lumbering foot. I have cracked the words filled in wine, the song that skirts the ones rehearsing, part of the old divine threat. Exquisite trailing stains. John has turned on The Body Snatcher by Robert Wise. One man leans over another, strangling on his knees, his vest getting tighter toward death, sleeves creeping up. A door closes over black ink, figures stricken with grief, this poor unfortunate mind, a gentleman of consequence who couldn't swallow the shame. I flip back through Lost Illusions, your copy, skipping, of course, his sojourn in the green woods and turning straight to SF and passing through Mexico, Tangiers, France, and London rewritten. His voice is like an ex-husband, knocking at the door, and worth my time again. Last night, trying to put the songs down right ways first. Lost track. Just odds and ends to clean up now. I am strongest before the world wakes.
You know, one last line of yours, you say that you may have to sacrifice beautiful and resplendent lines in service of the skeleton.
Yes, I think that's a very important. It's like a master lesson in poetry that, you know, you have this line that you've just been like dusting off, you know, every 10 seconds, you know, because you're so enamored with this line, but it doesn't really fit anywhere, you know, but you just can't bear yourself, you know, to like throw it out, but you just have to throw it out. It doesn't belong in that particular armature. It doesn't belong in that design.
So put it in the typewriter and see what happens.
Yeah, or use it as a title. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just hack off one of the limbs and maybe it might fit. You know, it just probably needs to calm down.
I'm so delighted you're going to come read It's Blab, and thank you for coming and being part of this interview.
Thank you so much. I've had a great time.